This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's access media station, Plains FM, and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Coming up next, conversations on human rights with Speak Up, Kōrerotia, here on Plains FM.
E nā mana, e nā reo, e nā hō e whā. Tēnā koutou katoa. Nō mai ki tēne hōtaka. Speak Up, Kōrerotia. Tune in as our guests speak up, sharing their unique and powerful experiences and opinions. And may you also be inspired to speak up when the moment's right.
This is Speak Up Kōrerotia, ko Sally Carlton aho. Today we are talking about the gender pay gap, or framed another way, gender pay equity. What are these issues? What are the big fundamental questions that go with them? And it seems a timely topic given that the 8th of March is International Women's Day. So this show will be airing in the lead up to that important day, which is a nice opportunity for us just to reflect on women's rights, how far we've come, and yet how far we also still have to go in many respects. We have two guests with us today who will be bringing perspectives on pay equity from quite different industries and sectors, which is great. We've got Anne Brower from the University of Canterbury, who brings, I guess, a bit of a research lens to all of this, and Erin Polatsuk from the New Zealand Council of Trade Unions. I presume you'll be talking a little bit more about the on-the-ground type of mahi that's going on. I'd love to hear more about each of you. What is it that you do, and how is it that you've kind of become involved and passionate about this sort of work? Anne, shall we hear from you first?
Sure. My name is Anne Brower. I teach geography and environmental science at the University of Canterbury. I got interested in pay equity, well, first of all, because I'm a woman and because I grew up in the 70s where we were sold the idea that girls could do anything. And it's true. I think girls can do anything. But the older I get, the more I realize that we can do most anything, but we just won't get paid the same for it. And the reason I got into gender pay equity or the gender pay gap from a professional sort of research point of view, just a bit by accident. I took a summer school statistics course and to upskill, you know? And so in order to prepare for that, I requested some data to play with in the stats course. And it needed to be simpler data than what I normally work with, which at the time was about land sales. And, you know, land sales, there's so many different characteristics of land that really it's near to impossible to predict what a piece of land is going to sell for. So I thought, okay, it needs to be simpler than that. And New Zealand runs this program for all lecturers in the country where we all get graded and scored on our research performance every 6 years. We also are all paid on a similar pay scale with similar steps and ranks, academic ranks. So lecturer, senior lecturer, associate professor, or professor. And that's similar across the whole country. So I thought, I know, for a simple research question, how about let's look at how research performance predicts rank, which is a direct correlation to how much we get paid. I wasn't expecting there to be much gender difference, but I just thought, oh, you know, for an intervening variable, why not gender? So I asked for the data, and like the first class of the semester, we were playing around and I just, you know, did the correlation and there were two lines, one for men and one for women. And they started at a different point and then they took a very different slope. And so they were very different lines. And I showed it to the lecturer and I said, I think these are two very different populations. What do you think? And she said, yes, they are absolutely two very different populations. And she said, what did you say these data were? And I told her. And she said, what are the two different lines? I said, men and women. And I said, so the data show your performance influences your pay. And I must say, to my surprise, in a merit-based university system, what I found was, and what came shining through very quickly in the analysis, was that men and women, how our pay is structured relative to how we perform on a research basis is very different. Whether that's caused by sexism or by whatever is different, but I can tell you men and women are very different populations in how we get paid within New Zealand universities.
Absolutely fascinating. And that struck a chord with you, obviously?
Then entered onto a journey of, first of all, learning a whole lot more about stats, learning a whole lot more about gender equity, because that was, to me, quite a surprising finding that it was both statistically significant and so different. At that time, it was 2018. So it was like, well, you know, we should be over this by now.
Matt and Erin, how about we hear about you, your journey into this mahi?
Oh, kia ora korua. That was such a good example of why, like, bringing it out into the sunlight is so important. So my background is actually with the union movement. I'm currently the acting secretary of the Council of Trade Unions, but I've worked in around and with unions for the last 20 years. And where I really started to work with issues of pay equity was when I joined the Public Service Association, Te Pūkingahere Tikanga Mahi, who at that time had launched a really successful campaign with 100%, which was trying to shine a spotlight on the fact that women's work is undervalued and wasn't paid at 100%. I want to just also acknowledge the intersectionality there too, that women who are disabled and wahine Māori or women who are Pacifica also experience many problems. Unions are all about collective power. We're about redistributing wealth. We're about fairness for working people. And obviously the gender pay gap is a big inequity issue for our whole lot of workers in this country. So we utilise very successfully the Equal Pay Act to use the claims process within that to win pay settlements for large occupational groups, which were dominated by female workers, and in many cases, workers who were Pacifica or Māori. I was excited by pay equity both as a campaigning tool to get women to come together to use their collective power and exercise that collective power to put more money into their pockets and remediate the injustices that they experience. There are limitations, obviously, to the Equal Pay Act, which I'm sure we can get into in a little while. But one of the things I found, this journey has been incredibly frustrating because it is a political issue and therefore it has this bit of a pendulum swing depending on who's in government. It is not just a linear line to being fixed. I mean, the gender pay gap is kind of like halved in the past, what, 27 years or something. Like, it's taking an extraordinarily long time to go anywhere. It's really frustrating. But then on the other hand, when I think about all of the pay equity campaigners that I've worked with, the women who have taken claims, the women who have organised and spoken with other workers, and the women who have reported an immense change in their life when they suddenly get paid what they're worth. Those things are kind of really heartening and keep me getting up every day to keep working on it. The pay equity settlements, I just want to say a little bit about what they show, because the average increase in pay at the other end of those settlements is over 30%. So that's an indication of how undervalued work that has been predominantly undertaken by women is. It's a huge figure. So if you think of all of these occupations out there that are mostly done by women, maybe think about retail. you can probably assume that the person who is working in retail next time you go and buy something is being paid at least 30% less than she ought to be. And, yeah, there's a lot of work to do.
I think statistics are going to be a key part of this quarter, aren't they? Just as we get into things, though, could you talk us through some of this terminology? And I'm particularly interested in hearing about your takes on the idea of the gender pay gap versus the idea of gender pay equity and the difference between them and why we should maybe focus on one or the other.
I think they're flip sides of the same coin. I think gender pay equity is the process of fixing the gender pay gap.
I'll be interested in Anne's view on this, being much more in the academic space, but it seems to me that there have been multiple methodologies used, and with a lack of mandatory reporting in this country, I think it's useful, but the use is limited. And what I would really like to see is some kind of consistency with the way that we report and measure, and some kind of compulsion for employers to do that so that they can't hide behind secrecy. And I also really, as I've mentioned before, am really keen on this idea that we look at occupational-based pay gaps as well as enterprise level and the global, because I think that's where the problem lies, is the segregation of work and across the New Zealand economy, that certain occupations are done by women that are of the same skill level as ones done by men, just paid a little less.
I have some statistical insight on that. I agree with you that the methods for measuring the gender pay gap or gender equity, whichever you're looking at, they have varied over time. And one of the things that we, my colleague Alex James and I, have tried to do in our work is methodologically and statistically pick apart those excuses for the gender pay gap. So, like, one of the things you said is the fields of work are quite gendered. So you talked about how most retail shop assistants are women, whereas most, say, plumbers are men. And those two professions get paid differently. So really, what's the problem? What are you complaining about? So that's one example of a methodological sort of excuse for, it's not really unfairness. It's just people choose different jobs. So we've done some work on that, all, again, within academia, just because it's more measurable, you know, and because we've got those performance measures that make it easier to measure. So one of the things we did is we looked across, I think it was 27 countries that have some sort of performance measure. Not quite as fine-tuned as New Zealand's scoring every lecturer every 6 years. So what we did is we got, I don't know how many, tens of thousands of people across these different fields across about 27 different countries. And then we looked at success within academia, which is often measured by whether you get a grant or not. And what we found is that, yeah, there are some gender gaps here and there in who gets what grants. It varies a lot by country. But what we found even more interesting is when you break down the different fields, like physics and French literature and philosophy and all the different fields that we teach, some of them are quite male-dominated, some are quite female-dominated. So physics is quite male-dominated. Education and nursing are quite female-dominated. Philosophy is quite male-dominated. Biology, psychology, they're pretty 50-50. And these patterns, the gender patterns, are not very different across the 27 countries. What we found, though, is that the more female-dominated a field, the less success they had. And the more male-dominated the field, the more success they had. So, and we thought, okay, well, maybe it's just because the male dominated fields are more counting, are more numbers based, more quantitative, like physics and mathematics and statistics. But philosophy is just as male dominated and follows the exact same pattern. And what was even more interesting about it, and this sort of sets the cat amongst the pigeon in gender equity, although in a very small field, academia, is that both men and women in physics and philosophy benefited from the male-dominated field boost in success, and both men and women in education were punished by the female-dominated aspect of their field, but men suffered less.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so breaking it down, one of the really fun things that I've learned about thinking statistically from this mathematician and colleague of mine, Alex James, is that if you think carefully about things, you can sort of test people's excuses and go, okay, here's some data and some methods that will test that. Let's just use that as a testable hypothesis. And a lot of them don't stack up. Another excuse people use is babies. Women have babies, they take career breaks, that means that over a career they earn less. Well, again, we used the National New Zealand data to test that hypothesis. And what we found is that babies cannot explain what we observed in New Zealand universities, because babies might explain why men and women have different research performance scores, but they don't explain the discrepancy between that. If I get an A, which is the top score, and my friend down the hall who's a similar age, teaches similar stuff and got the same grade as me, it doesn't explain why he's twice as likely to be a professor as I am. Yeah. Babies can't explain that. They could explain why I might get a lower score because I have more on my plate and I might have less time to do research. But the score to pay discrepancy, no, babies don't explain that.
I think that whole, that lie around choice when it comes to the gender pay gap is a way to avoid thinking about this as a systemic issue. You know, it's a way of trying to put it back on the individual and saying, well, you made the wrong choice. You went into the wrong field of study. You went into the wrong occupation. And then when you look at where women work, they're in occupations we need and increasingly need in society. We have an aging population in New Zealand. We need more people caring for the elderly, for example. Yeah. We need more people having children and looking after those children. Blaming women for those choices is actually counter to what our society needs, but it's actually wrong in so many provable ways. And you'll probably know that when women move into a male-dominated occupational group, to the extent that they begin to dominate in that group, the wages reduce. So it's not at all about just moving over there and you'll be wealthier.
Yeah.
No, the patriarchal capitalist system has built into it the systemic issue that women's roles aren't valued, right? So that's kind of the issue that we have to deal with. And just while I'm on my hobby horse about that, I'm someone who just kind of irritates me, the term bias. Every time if somebody says bias, I think you're just politely saying sexism, you know?
Exactly.
And we do just have to name it. We have to notice it's there, and we then just have to fix it, you know? We can overcome as people these, you know, these discriminatory bits of ourselves, you know? Anyway, I would hope my children will choose whatever occupation they want, and I hope they don't get discriminated on the basis of their gender for it.
Yeah, I was just about to mention that there was an economist at, I think, Brown University, who did a lot of work on the feminization of professions. Law used to be a very male-dominated field, and now there's many more women in it. And she did an amazing set of studies in the US that looked over decades how pay in these various occupations changed when the gender spread in the field changed. That's a known thing, and it's been known since about the 1990s, and it's not just New Zealand.
When I talked about that political ping-ponging that goes on around dealing with pay equity, one of the things I've observed over the years is that governments like the one we have now tend toward the arguments around choice. You know, women should just choose differently. The arguments around just get more women into male-dominated trades or whatever, and then we've got, you know, issues fixed.
Everybody's pay goes down.
Yeah. Whereas the real approach, the only way, in my view, to really deal with it is to, let's be honest about the fact that we live in a patriarchal society and that has been hurting women, and including economically, and let's utilise the Equal Pay Act to remediate where this has historically happened, and in addition put in place an industry bargaining mechanism so that we can keep women's pay rates at the appropriate rate and not have them sink again over time. Because currently our bargaining is so fractured in New Zealand that every enterprise, every business can essentially have its own collective agreement. They easily go out of step. If you're an administrative worker working at a small plumbing place over here, and you're an administrative worker working, you know, at a lawyer's office over here, you might get paid quite differently, and over time that will go out of sync again, and you won't be able to maintain your rates as an administrative profession. So we need a way, a mechanism for bargaining to do that, and we had a lot of hope that fair pay agreements would be that mechanism when they were introduced, and we still seek, as a union movement, that type of approach. So on the one hand, fix the problem, and then on the other hand, make sure it doesn't occur again.
Coming at it from a more academic, scientific perspective, my co-authors and I have to be quite careful to not call it sexism, because we cannot know what the cause of all these gender gaps that we are observing are. We can just observe the gender gap. And yeah, sure, there's all sorts of possible explanations, but you can never sort of statistically show that it's bias. Or actually, no, you can, but it's people with different skills from me. I was just telling my students about teaching evaluations where they've done a study where the students don't know whether their teacher is male or female. In online courses, they've swapped the male name for the female name. So even though they're getting the exact same education, they give lower evaluations to the woman. A colleague and I call it the double whammy, where I think society, or at least universities, have higher expectations for women. So we're expected to do more. So we struggle under the weight of that. But then if in the university say, no, I'm not going to take on those extra quite gendered roles of student care and this or that, if we say no, we'll be punished for that. So we're punished whichever way we go. So we're expected to be nice, and we don't get rewarded for being nice. If we ever dare to say, no, I won't be extra nice, we get punished for that. Whereas men get rewarded for being nice, at least in my workplace. Mm-hmm. We're just expected to do that.
I was thinking you're not encouraging me but actually that kind of makes me think about some of the evaluation surveys and so on that have taken place when there has been a successful pay equity claim settlement, that women will say, now that I'm getting paid the rate that I should be getting paid, now that things are settled, I'm more likely to recommend this job to other people, you know, and I'm more likely to kind of build this up. And it sort of makes me think about how, you know, equality is good for industry and good for everyone, you know.
And diversity is good for a workplace.
Mm-hmm.
But diversity, it doesn't last long if it doesn't if it's not an equitable workplace. And the thing I wanted to add to your, you were talking about how equity is a political hot potato. The other thing about equity is that it's deeply unpopular. If you're on the right side of an inequity, you don't want that inequity to change. If you're on the right side of a gender pay gap, and you know, say you've earned the professor title that you hold, it will be deeply offensive to you to think that some of the speed with which you earned that title might come because of your gender. And so I think as a society, rightly so, we're getting much more open to inclusion and diversity in the workplace. But equity, no, we don't want that. Because again, if you're on the right side of an inequity, you're not going to want to change it. Half of us are on the right side of an inequity. That's the nature of the numbers. So at least half of us are not going to want to change it.
There have been a lot of changes over the years of working with unions and pay equity. But I think there was a fear at the beginning that if your male-dominated role was used as one of the comparators, that might somehow bring down the value of your role, or that conversely, if a female-dominated occupation within your workforce, let's just pick on admin again, suddenly comes up and the differential between your role and that role is closing, that somehow you are being injured by that, which is not the case because your payroll hasn't changed at all. Your role is still the same. Your pay is still the same. It's just that they've had that bump up. So I think there is something that we do kind of have to shift in the way we perceive equity. Yeah. And the other thing that's been really challenging for people, and I think we've come a long way over the years on this, is that when you compare work of equal value, which is what the Equal Pay Act asks you to do, that you're not looking at work that is in any way the same in terms of the tasks. So you're looking at whether the work has a kind of similar skill level, whether the responsibilities are kind of the same level, whether the same degree of efforts required by that work, and whether the conditions of that work are kind of at the same level. So those are they're quite abstract, but that's the legal test for whether work is valued the same. That has been a bit of a mental hurdle for people too, because whether you're on the side of the claimant or the side of the person you're being compared to, people were saying our jobs aren't alike, you know. And that was quite stark in the early case with the care workers comparing to correction officers. And obviously if your day job is to support somebody who's living with disability, you don't like to think of yourself at all as the correction officer, right? Because you're not comparing tasks, you're comparing skills, responsibility, degrees, method, all of those things, you know. So it's a real challenge for people, but it's working. We've just had to figure out how to work through that process.
I saw something recently about the university fees that people pay, for example, nursing students, midwifery students, taking much longer to pay off their student loans, not necessarily because the course is more expensive, but because they're not given the same financial support whilst doing the course, and then it takes them longer to pay up because they're getting paid less. I thought that was quite interesting as well.
Because they have to do placements.
Yep.
And those placements aren't always paid.
Exactly.
It's not that they have to pay more for the course, but it's the lost opportunity of earning while they're doing placements.
You're coming out into lower paid work, which is, they would have an impact surely of how.
That's right. Yeah.
That kind of reminds me, Sally, that there's some information around how much less women retire with because of the gender pay gap as well. And we do statistically live, is it still 7 years longer than men? And we'll probably retire with 60,000 or more less than our male counterparts because of the gender pay gap, the cumulative effect of it over the years. It sort of disadvantages us at every stage, doesn't it?
Yeah.
How about when we think about intersectionality? It occurred to me as I was listening to you talking, Anne, about the extra responsibilities on female academics, that sort of caring role that there are extra responsibilities placed on Māori academics, Pacific academics, for example, to take up some of these extracurricular voluntary positions on committees or whatever, the stuff that isn't kind of paid as extra hours, but is part of their role. And I know that this is a huge issue when it comes to pay equity as well, is the different ethnic groups and disability and age and all sorts of other kind of intersections coming into play.
Yeah, because then all that time that you spend on those committees and things, you're not spending on your primary job that you get paid for and promoted for if you know, when you do a job. The other thing about representation on committees, like there's been another suggested fix for gender pay gaps, which is, you know, you just need to put more women on the hiring committees. Well, sorry, but sadly, and very sadly, that doesn't work either. Because, again, studies show women are just as, if not more so, biased against women in hiring decisions than men are. I think part of that is a hangover from when it was perceived that there were only so many slots for women. I was on some committee. Oh, I know what it was. We were hiring teaching assistants, tutors. And someone said, oh, well, we've only hired female tutors. And I said, well, number one, our courses are actually heavily female dominated now. It's fair to say that the top scorers are female. Not all, but, you know, female dominated. And, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, I doubt that anybody raised an issue when all the tutors happened to be male. It's only now that the university population is female dominated that where there are environments where there are no men becomes a problem. It wasn't a problem when there were no women.
What I could say around ethnicity is that the Equal Pay Act, which is the tool that we use for these big settlements, doesn't consider ethnicity within it. So we don't actually have a legislative framework to use to have the same kind of effect. That's why unions, when they decide who to take the claims for, tend to think about where are our lowest paid membership? Where are our Māori members? Where, you know, that's kind of the internal criteria that gets assessed. But we have to drive it through the Equal Pay Act on a gender basis because there's no other law.
That I didn't know. That is really interesting. Well, should we have a break and have a wire-up? And you've suggested Dolly Parton's 9 to 5?
Sure.
Sounds great.
Out of bed and I stumble to the kitchen, pour myself a cup of ambition and yawn and stretch and try to come to life. Jump in the shower and the blood starts pumping, out on the streets the traffic starts jumping with folks like me on the job from 9 to 5. Working 9 to 5, what a way. Step on the boss man's ladder, but you got dreams he'll never take away. In the same boat with a lot of your friends, waiting for the day your ship will come in and the tide's gonna turn and it's all gonna roll your way. Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living, barely getting by. It's all taking and no giving. They just use your mind and you never get the credit. It's enough to drive you crazy if you let it.
Speak Up Core Rotorua, and we're speaking with Erin Podlaksuk from the Council of Trade Unions and Anne Brower from University of Canterbury about the gender pay gap and gender pay equity. We have been talking quite a lot about what these issues mean, but I'd be really keen to think about really explicitly what are some of the implications of this pay gap. Erin, I know you touched on things like women retire with less money, they spend more time paying off their student loans. It's kind of across the life cycle, but how about some of these other implications?
I can speak a little bit to some of the comments that came out from people after receiving over 30% pay settlements, bringing them up from often minimum wage level to something more livable. And it's when you read and hear those comments that you realise what they were suffering beforehand. An evaluation of one of them said that there was a 52% decrease in people skipping a meal. So that means that prior to that settlement, people were choosing not to eat because they were using their money on other things and didn't have enough to go around, and probably were also feeding other people because women are often responsible for others. There was a 54% decrease of those who went without medical care. So prior to the pay equity settlement, they were deciding not to see a doctor because it was unaffordable. Some of the statements that came through from one of the claims run of PSA that I read many years ago made me cry and have stuck in my heart since. It was just people talking about going to Australia for the first time to see their grandchild who they haven't seen, or not having to work the third job. You know, these are stories of what it really means to be lifted out of poverty as a working person and being provided finally with a living wage. And it's outrageous that that's what they should have been receiving all of that time, and instead were being forced into, you know, the working poor category on the basis of the gender that they have. it is outrageous. So I think some of those kind of personal stories and the impact it has are really powerful. I spoke at a conference once that was full of men, very male-dominated group, about pay equity. Didn't know how I would be received at that. It was about the claims process that we were using and the outcomes we were getting. And the first person who stood up at the mic to ask me a question afterwards told a really moving story about how his wife had been the recipient of a pay equity settlement, was finally getting paid what she deserved, and was finally getting paid more than her son. And you know, I think that just seems to me really strange that, you know, young people enter the workforce, they see their mum's been undervalued, and they might go into jobs that we'd be getting paid higher than her, even though she might have been in those roles for, I don't know, 20, 30 years. Yeah. It was quite incredible stuff there. Just really mindful of the fact that single parent families in this country are more likely to be headed by a woman than by a man, a mother usually, but a grandmother maybe. And so when women's roles are undervalued, it just has this huge impact on families. And there's often this talk publicly about child poverty. And every time I hear it, I think, yeah, that woman's wages is what lies behind that. Yeah. Lots of other things as well.
I can't really give personal anecdotes, but when I got my first job out of university, my mother said, you know, that's more than I ever earned.
There you go.
And my mother had a university degree. And
what was her job?
She worked in a university doing editing at scientific writing with and for other people. But I was going to say that there has been research done on the effects of a gender pay gap. And one of the studies that I found to be most affecting or most powerful was, again, it was a U.S. study, and it was huge. It was over 20,000 workers in sort of corporate type
jobs, accounting firms and places like that. And they looked at levels of ambition within the career and within their company. And one of the things that they found was that perceiving your workplace to be equitable and perceiving that I have the same chances of being promoted as the guy down the hall from me, that is a stronger driver of my level of ambition than having children. So again, people tend to say, oh, well, women have children, and so their priorities change and their ambition changes. I don't have children. I can't speak to that. But it could be actually caused by something else.
I did wonder about the sort of the impact on motivation generally. If you realize that you're getting paid less than your male colleague, it's presumably fairly demotivating.
Well, this huge study found that that was the bigger driver of changes in ambition than having children was, even though children is a commonly cited cause.
Just thinking about the lack of a mandatory reporting regime for the gender pay gap in New Zealand, and some organizations do report because they must see it as good for their reputation and good for recruitment, right? Otherwise, why would you? So this sort of flows on from what you're saying, and maybe they think if they put themselves out there as being an equitable organization, because they're probably reporting because they've got comparatively low independent, they might keep some talent in, you know, women might stay and all the skills that they bring. Anyway, it should be necessary for everybody to be reporting on that, though, so we can choose which jobs we go into with our eyes wide open.
I agree. However, the older I get, the more cynical I get, and the more I think that you can actually hide a gender pay gap pretty easily, you know, just with different job responsibilities. Again, I talk about the university because I work within a university, but there are admin roles that are female dominated, and there are technical roles that are male dominated. They each have a skill set that is required for various things to keep the university running. Take a wild guess, which is paid more. And it's legitimately sort of paid more because they're just on a different pay band. You know, it's not that we're biased against women. It's just that this job is at that pay band. And I don't know that that's, unless you do it really well and really carefully, something like that, the admin versus technical, or the philosophy versus nursing. That sort of thing would not turn up.
That's right. So maybe I'm simplifying it too much by saying, a shared methodology is the fix. Maybe it's more than that. You know, when you talk about the excuses people use, I have heard that excuse before, like, oh, yeah, of course she gets paid less because that's an admin role. You know, and so back to, you know, the legal test around what are the skills and responsibilities and degrees of effort conditions of work for. Administrative work is really difficult work. It's got lots of complexity to it, and not everybody can do it.
You get it wrong, all the wheels come off. The organization grinds to all.
Yeah. You know, they'll say, oh, that's the admin role, that's why, as though the undervaluation of admin work is somehow a natural phenomenon, not a result of bias and years of undervaluation of women's skill sets.
Comes down to that feminization of work. As a field becomes more female, it becomes less valued.
As we finish up, what would you like to see happen? We've talked about the transparency in reporting and it being, yes, a good idea, but potentially flawed. But what would kind of be a really good thing you'd like to see in terms of pay equity?
In my opinion, the most effective way to lift women's wages and to address past undervaluation is through the pay equity claims process. which is in the Equal Pay Act. It needs improvements. It's currently quite a lengthy and complicated process, and it doesn't have an easy way of acknowledging intersectional discrimination. So that would be what I would like to see happen, is some overtime fixing up of that legislation and more claims being run through it, so that all female-dominated occupational groups are lifted to the rate they're at. And like I said before, an industry mechanism for keeping workers' terms and conditions kind of steady and moving forward, so that things don't repeat. I would love to see a mandatory agreed reporting mechanism for the gender pay gap as well. Although, as you're probably picking up, I kind of care a little bit less about the reporting on it and the numbers, is the actual real life stuff, the meaningful stuff, like getting money in the pockets of women who can't afford to go to a doctor today, those sorts of things. I want more women to join the union, because the unions are the ones running the claim.
I think that reporting, it's a precondition. Of course, we should be reporting on this. I guess I've seen gender reports that very conveniently hide some serious inequities. I mean, the simple answer is, oh my goodness, just pay women more. I'm not saying pay women more than men. I'm just saying
it's 100% pay for women.
Exactly. We know that the gender pay gap is, it's hovering around, 7-8% now? Would it be that hard to just say, okay, women, you get a 7% pay jump. And then in 10 years' time, we'll look at it again, and then maybe men will be paid less. Okay, so then fine, give men a 2% pay jump. I think those pay equity claims are fantastic, and I fully support them. Kia kaha, go you. I think that's great, but they take too long.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
You know what? We know. Mm-hmm. We know the data, and I think the more that we drill down into it to say, oh, well, it's all the legal ins and outs, although I support all of that, this 7%, it's not changing. Mm-hmm. It hasn't changed in a long time. An easier, quicker way to do it, where we wouldn't actually spend all that money figuring out the equal effort, equal opportunity, equal qualifications, all of that. Why don't we just pay women 7% more? Spend that money on paying us a little bit more.
There is a really frustrating thing that now that we've got settled pay equity claims for nurses and social workers and administrators and the public service and administrators and public hospitals and teacher aides and a number of other groups, right? And they all show that the undervaluation is over 30%. You know, that there's huge amount, that there's big gap between what women were getting paid and what they should have been getting paid, right? So just to use your kind of blunt tool, and why not just say every female dominated occupational group is likely to be, on the basis of all these little claims, over 30% undervalued. So why don't we chuck on 30% straight pay rates, right? And then you fix it, and then we just work on the mechanism for keeping it steady and moving forward.
Yep, I'm with you.
Yep.
I think in the female-dominated fields, the discrepancy is more. But even in the not female-dominated fields, women get paid less. There is so much evidence out there. I mean, I've read a lot of these studies. There's so much evidence out there from New Zealand, from elsewhere. We know what the pay gap is. Just pay women more.
Even the like-for-like in the same employer, right? You can be sitting next to someone. Their pay gap's right, you know, at that level as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Another way to put that is to say that, like, our whole society has kind of been marching forward on the back of unpaid labour. If you think about, you know, the period of time that women are working for free from, that's always pointed out as a kind of stunt to show, well, there's unpaid work going on here. And this is what we've been relying on. As a society, we need to fix it if we really do care about child poverty. Just put that back in, because it sounds like people do. They just don't seem to correlate that to, like, what mothers are paid.
Yeah, I never thought about it in those terms, but you're absolutely right.
child poverty yet. I never thought about it as single parent households. It's a very direct correlation there.
Okay, tēnā kōrua. Thank you very much. I'm sure that this has stimulated a lot of thinking from our listeners. Certainly got me thinking a lot as well, which is great. Thank you very much for taking the time and for sharing your different perspectives and your expertise. It's been really great having your on-the-ground knowledge, Erin, and all that research wealth of knowledge that you bring. And that's been really, really enlightening as well.
Thank you, Sally. Thank you, Anne.
Thank you.
We've got time for another song, and Erin suggested a song by her cousin Vera.
This is an amazing song by an amazing Wellington artist called Vera Allen, and the song is called Carpenter.
I call the carpenter, I broke the furniture, I don't know where to sit, I think I'm gonna quit. I call the therapist, I've got an iron fist, I'm putting weight on it, I'm gonna break my wrist. I'll keep calling, I'll keep calling, yeah, like I did.
I'll keep trying.